We're going to listen to an important science presentation.
Now, I know you probably can't read this next slide at the back, or probably not at the front either, but I really like this slide.
Can scientists learn the art of communication? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
This was before anesthesia, so all of the surgeries were all done on people who were wide awake.
It was hard to come up with something that just wasn't sort of invoking magic.
Then to me, it suggests that the universe is much more about the dark matter than it is about us.
The two-dimensional plane is the dance floor,
we are,
and the particles are the dancers.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organs.
Unfortunately, the data didn't pan out that way.
Exactly.
Not as problems to be solved, but as human beings.
On today's show, a museum filled with skulls and body parts inspires art. And doctors say legislation can get in the way of their relationship with patients. But first up, death by PowerPoint. Monotone voice, incomprehensible jargon. Ugh, we've all suffered that, right? Listening to science presentations. And it makes you wonder, doesn't anybody teach scientists how to present their work? Or is it not really their job to be good communicators? Susan Phillips takes a look at talking science.
Okay, what if you heard?
The change in net irradiance at the tropopause after allowing for stratospheric temperatures to readjust to radiative equilibrium.
Are you following? Me neither. But what if he said,
the sun shines down on Earth, warming our oceans, burning our skin, heating the asphalt. The numbers suggest more and more the heat is getting absorbed by the Earth and its inhabitants, and less is being reflected out into space. This makes the Earth hotter.
Well, now you know I'm describing global warming. Scientists face a struggle all the time. How to talk about their work in a way that everyone gets, but remains true to the science. And how not to wince the next day when the headlines miss the nuances in what they tried to say. 29-year-old Christina Love teaches physics at Drexel University. During her years of science education, she got no formal training in how to communicate with non-scientists, and that's not unusual.
So this is kind of the current model of our galaxy. So you see these beautiful pictures of our galaxy. One model shows for dark matter that the galaxy's deep way down in this huge spherical halo of dark matter. We're surrounded by it. And so it's here, but you can't detect it. And that's the idea.
Love is in a room full of scientists at the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Center City, Philadelphia. They're standing around posters explaining their work. Get-togethers like this are something scientists do all the time with other scientists. But this time, this event is open to the public. And scientific jargon, it's discouraged. Love organized this event called Start Talking Science to coax scientists to talk about their work in a more accessible way to non-experts.
When I first learned about dark matter, I was an undergraduate at Westchester, and I really wanted to scream. I thought, how is this possible? How have I not known this up until now? I went through all of, you know, my grade school and high school thinking we know everything, and it turns out what we know is less than 5% of the entire universe. So there's just some really amazing things out there that that everyone deserves to know and understand.
In the last 10 years, major scientific societies have begun holding workshops on communications. Some have even established big money prizes to promote the idea. Naomi Oreskes teaches the history of science at Harvard, and she's written extensively about funding for climate change skeptics.
There's definitely been a change from a feeling 10 years ago that it was the job of scientists to do the science as well and as accurately as possible, but that it was really someone else's job to communicate it. And most scientists I knew and I talked to really thought it was your job, that it was the job of science journalists. And scientists used to get mad because they felt that science journalists did a poor job.
Oreskes says controversies around politically charged topics such as climate change have led a lot of scientists to rethink how they talk about their work. If the science is complicated, she says, it's a delicate art to simplify without dumbing it down.
I always like to say it's not dumbing it down, it's cleaning it up, right? But how to make that clean up, how to sort of polish it and make it presentable in a way that's not misleading, it's not trivial.
She says one of the best science communicators to emerge from the lab into the public sphere is this guy.
We have to accept that we don't live in a world where scientists can simply do the science, publish it, and assume that it will translate to good public policy. It doesn't work that way.
That's Penn State climate scientist Michael Mann. If he sounds like he's on the warpath for better science communication, he is.
We have to be out there defending the science, informing the electorate, explaining the science and its implications, because if we don't, it means special interests, front groups, paid attack dogs will simply poison the discussion with misinformation and disinformation.
Mann's views are shaped by personal experience. In 1998, he co-authored a paper that looked at weather patterns from medieval times by analyzing ice cores and tree rings. And in this paper was a simple little graph, one he thought pretty uninteresting. But the graph communicated his findings so well, so easily to a lay audience that it got a lot of press. Then he became a top target for those who claim climate change is a hoax. He was called before Congress. His emails were hacked. At one point, in a national magazine, he was referred to as the, quote, Jerry Sandusky of climate change.
I never envisioned that majoring in physics and applied math and going into the study of the climate system would place me at the center of, you know, what may be the most contentious debate that we have faced as a society. I didn't sign up for that.
But now man has embraced it. That iconic chart is now known as the hockey stick graph. It shows how the average temperature of the Earth has risen dramatically since the start of the Industrial Revolution. Mann wrote a book on his experiences, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Mann says back before the famous graph, he was pretty naive and just wanted to stay in his lab doing nerdy calculations. He's now an advocate for scientists to get out of their bunkers and engage the public.
And part of that is using metaphors and thinking, trying to get outside of your own scientific comprehension of the issue and think about how, you know, how would I think about this if I wasn't a climate scientist, if I wasn't a scientist at all?
Mann says the challenges include widespread misconceptions about the scientific process.
We don't prove things in science. We establish, you know, best explanations for observed phenomena. We apply, you know, weights of evidence. We pose hypotheses, and then we look at the observations and we see if they support the hypotheses. And it's this iterative process. There are huge uncertainties at the base of every area of science. That doesn't mean that we know nothing.
Mann and Oreskes, the Harvard professor, agree that the problem for scientists is not just a lack of skill or comfort with public speaking. Science sits at the center of many major public policy debates. Economic interests on both sides look for science that supports their position and will attack findings that don't. That point is not lost on younger scientists like physicist Christina Love.
It's almost a fear of not explaining it properly and then all of a sudden becoming the next controversy. So you kind of see that with evolution and with climate change, and at the risk of getting cosmologists in trouble, I don't really feel like the Big Bang Theory is attacked all that much. And I don't really understand why it isn't.
Maybe the explanation is that even though some think the Big Bang conflicts with the Bible, the theory doesn't really threaten anyone's livelihood. Yet. For The Pulse, I'm Susan Phillips.
Now, our next story is sure to be a popular audience darling because it involves the great Ernest Hemingway, fishing trips, and somehow it's still a science story. Hemingway is, of course, best known for his classic books, The Sun Also Rises, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and The Old Man and the Sea. And he made a contribution to marine science. Hemingway was an avid sport fisherman, and for 6 weeks in 1934, he hosted two Philadelphians on a scientific expedition on his boat in the Florida Straits. On the anniversary of Hemingway's 1954 win of the Nobel Prize in Literature, Carolyn Beeler has a look at the unexpected connection between the author and the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia.
In 1934, the Academy's fish expert, Henry Fowler, was researching a book on big game fish of the Atlantic. Hemingway invited Fowler and the Academy's director, Charles Cadwallader, to join him on his beloved fishing boat, the Pilar.
They stayed for 6 weeks, and every day the three of them went out on the boat, looking at fish, talking about fish, and trying to catch fish.
That's Academy senior fellow Bob Peck. He says the serious Fowler and Cadwallader balanced out the famously hard-drinking Hemingway, who took his contribution to science seriously.
Hemingway, it turns out, had a great deal of knowledge in this subject. He was a sports fisherman, yes, but he was also a very keen observer. And Hemingway realized that in order to get the correct identification of the fish and to understand what they looked like in the wild, Fowler and Cadwallader would need to see them coming out of the water and onto the deck. So their colors hadn't changed yet.
For years after the expedition, Hemingway sent specimens and accounts of his fishing trips back to Philadelphia. The Academy now has dozens of black and white photos and yellowing letters from the author in its collection.
A typical letter from Hemingway to Fowler in 1934 reads, "Am sending by the ferry this morning to be re-iced in Key West and shipped to you one of the small tuna-shaped fish that looks from length of fin to be possibly an albacore. This fish in life was a dark purple on the back, opalescent on the flanks and belly with a gold rather than silver shine. The fins were purple-blue on top and silver on the bottom." You can see how specific these descriptions are. To his detailed description of the fish, he added some culinary advice. "If you don't want him as a specimen and he gets there in good shape, wash the salt out, cut the meat off both sides of the backbone, and broil it."
The Academy did not, in fact, broil that albacore tuna. Actually, they still have it. It's been leached of those purples and golds, but otherwise is well-preserved in a glass jar of ethanol. A photo from the Academy's collection shows Hemingway on a fishing trip from around that time. He's tanned and youthful, with thick brown hair, a mustache, and a squinty-eyed grin. He poses on a boat deck with two Atlantic sailfish hanging on either side of him.
We think of him, of course, as the great bearded, iconic figure that Joseph Karsh photograph made so famous. But here he is, a much younger man, and clearly in the prime of life.
He has this expression on his face. It's sort of slightly cocky.
One might even say arrogant, but he's really just like a boy who's so excited about catching these fish.
Hemingway included details he learned about the Gulf Stream from the Academy scientists in his book, The Old Man and the Sea. A 1958 film version of the story captures the epic struggle between the luckless fisherman Santiago and the biggest catch of his life.
"He's longer than the skiff."
In the film, Spencer Tracy reels in a flashing blue marlin by hand from a small wooden boat.
"Oh, he's a great fish. Thank God they are not as intelligent as we who kill them, although they are more noble."
In the name of Hemingway, Bob Peck and marine biologists are in Cuba this week trying to help those noble creatures. With the onset of industrialized fisheries, populations of large fish plummeted by more than 90% in the second half of the 20th century. On Monday, Peck sailed with Hemingway's grandsons to the village that inspired The Old Man and the Sea. It's part of a campaign to create a joint U.S.-Cuba fish monitoring program. Marlin, sailfish, and tuna travel extensively between Florida and Cuba. But Peck says because of the embargo, there's little communication between scientists on either side of the Florida Straits.
But as Hemingway would have been the first to argue, science really knows no boundaries. And as these fish become more and more endangered by overfishing and environmental concerns, this is a time for our countries to reach out and to work cooperatively to try to protect the fish.
Hemingway and the Academy scientists never returned to the sea together after the 1934 expedition. But the fish expert Fowler was so grateful for his time on the Pilar that in 1935 he named a fish he discovered off the coast of Cape May after him, the Neomorinthae Hemingwayi, more commonly known as the spiny-cheek scorpion fish. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And of course, we have pictures of the Hemingway letters on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up, a new report predicts a bleak future for the nation's birds.
The combination of all these subtle changes to that bird's environment will make it very difficult for them to continue to live. In the same way that if people have changes to their daily routine and the food they eat and the places that they go, it disrupts your life in a lot of different ways.
That's next here on The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. A new national report from the Audubon Society paints a very grim picture for the country's bird populations. Global warming threatens the survival of nearly half the bird species in the continental United States and Canada, including many of the region's birds. This is according to a 7-year study conducted by the Society. Joining us now to discuss the research is Keith Russell. He's Urban Important Bird Area Coordinator for Audubon, Pennsylvania. That means he helps identify areas that are important to bird species survival. Keith, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Keith, how was the report conducted?
Well, in a nutshell, Audubon analyzed 40 years of citizen science data about the summer and winter distributions of North America's birds. And the analysis indicated that 314 species of birds in North America are probably going to lose a significant portion of their geographic distributions because of climate change over the next 70 years.
Could you give us an example of what exactly threatens these birds? Is it that it's getting too warm and maybe what they eat is changing? What exactly is affecting them?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. There are things that happen when climate changes. So phenologies of when plants bloom and when certain insects are around will change. You will have melting of the polar ice caps so that sea level will rise. And you could also have salt water moving further north up the Delaware River in our area, so that we no longer have fresh water in the Delaware River, but brackish water, and certain species won't be able to live in brackish water that are there right now.
The report looked at almost 600 species. What are some in this region that might be affected?
Well, here in Pennsylvania, for example, our state bird is a ruffed grouse, and that's not a migratory bird, so it can't move around very easily. And its habitat is predicted to change significantly because of climate. And so that bird will have to move north or else it won't have areas that it can use.
What kind of bird is that? Describe it for us.
The ruffed grouse is a chicken-like bird. It forages on the ground. It's the size of a chicken. It's brown. And it's very distinctive because when it mates, the males will sit on a log and they'll flap their wings against their body, and it makes this sound. It sort of sounds like a lawnmower starting up. It's just boom, 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 boom. You can hear it for quite a distance, and it's a really neat bird.
And why is that bird affected? What is changing that will make life hard?
Well, the habitat that that bird uses is going to change. There'll be different species of trees. It will be a lot warmer, and so it will affect the food sources that that bird uses in the summer and the winter. And so the combination of all these subtle changes to that bird's environment will make it very difficult for them to continue to live. In the same way that if people have changes to their daily routine and the food they eat and the places that they go, it disrupts your life in a lot of different ways. And it could be that you have so many changes you can no longer carry on your life as you know it now, and you either have to go somewhere else or make some serious adjustments. Birds can't make the types of adjustments people can. In many cases, their behaviors are often more stereotyped. So it's more difficult for them to adapt to some of these changes.
What are some of the other species in our region that might be affected?
Well, in addition to the ruffed grouse, which is considered climate endangered, the bald eagle, which is a bird we all know is our national bird and breeds in Philadelphia, is also on that climate endangered list, and the osprey. Some of the birds that are considered to be climate threatened in our area are the Baltimore oriole, the scarlet tanager, the wood thrush, and the American woodcock. It's a broad list of species that includes water birds, land birds, marsh birds, all kinds of things.
Is there anything we can do about this?
Well, besides supporting organizations that are really fighting on a national level to change policies that are allowing global warming to go forward, I think that you can look at what you can do at your own property, if you own property, to encourage native plants. If you have a yard and you can plant more native plants, that will help your yard to be a more resilient area to our native birds.
Keith, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Keith Russell is Urban Important Bird Area Coordinator for Audubon, Pennsylvania, and we have posted a link to Audubon's Birds and Climate Change report on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Our next story takes us to the doctor's office.
All right, so you're here for your first visit today.
Yes.
Are you having any problems?
Usually, there are two people in the room, the doctor and the patient. They are discussing symptoms, problems, and potential solutions.
Are you comfortable most of the time, or is it just when you do some trigger foods or alcohol?
Some doctors say these days there are other voices crowding out that intimate conversation between a doctor and patient.
Page 14 of today's House calendar, the chair recognizes a gentleman from York County, Representative Evans.
Tanya Engler spoke with some doctors and found out why they are concerned about something they call legislative intrusion.
Doctors say a number of new laws tell them what they can or can't say to a patient. Five of the biggest professional groups representing the country's pediatricians, family doctors, and surgeons all laid out their case in a recent opinion piece. Internist Steven Weinberger is CEO of the American College of Physicians. He co-authored the article in the New England Journal of Medicine. He says the one big example is in Florida. That law, dubbed the Docs and Glocks rule, restricts how doctors talk about guns in the home.
They want to be free to ask the patients, do you own a firearm? Is there a child or are there children in the house? Is it kept locked up?
Florida doctors can ask about guns, but only if there's a medical reason. Critics say that exception is too vague.
It was left up to the patient if the patient felt it was an appropriate question. That patient could then complain about the physician, and the sanctions would be significant. Heavy fines, loss of physician's license to practice.
That's a major disincentive to even mention guns at all, Weinberger says. Lots of things factor into what a doctor says or does for a patient. And Florida internist Stuart Himmelstein says lawmakers shouldn't be in the middle of that equation.
The legislatures work
sorry to be cynical, but they work on political agendas.
Himmelstein cares for mostly older adults in his practice in Delray Beach, Florida. He says it's appropriate to ask about guns if a wife comes in worried about a husband with dementia, or if a patient has a history of depression or violence.
Or when I have a patient that comes into my office with too many bruises, I might want to be inclined to make sure that the home is safe.
Doctors are sending up red flags about legislation that they say gets in the way of giving patients independent medical care and advice. Steven Weinberger says in Virginia, one proposal required an invasive ultrasound for every woman seeking an abortion.
This is a look inside the uterus with a probe that sends sound waves. And it's actually putting the probe into a woman's vagina. And the legislators are saying that this must be done, when in fact physicians have said there is absolutely no reason to do this.
That attempt back in 2012 made headlines all across the country. And eventually, Virginia lawmakers revised the rule. In Pennsylvania, there's a law that requires doctors to check oxygen levels of every newborn baby. Another law gives doctors a script to read when a pregnant woman learns her baby may have Down syndrome. Critics are worried about what they call legislative intrusion. But obstetrician-gynecologist Peter Gearhart says that term may be too harsh.
Well, that has a negative connotation. I think a lot of healthcare laws get created by legislators that truly have good intentions.
Gearhart leads a busy medical practice near Pennsylvania Hospital.
She just had a baby, so we're here to see how she's doing.
Hey, how are you?
He says he's supposed to have a conversation with every pregnant woman about harvesting umbilical cord blood. It's a pricey option, but could be a lifesaver for families with certain inherited genetic conditions.
That sort of seems like it's derived from a special interest that lobbied the legislature to develop that requirement.
Gearhart has limited time, lots of information that he needs to share, and he says every woman's needs are different.
Should we require physicians to talk to their patients about looking both ways before they cross the street? Where do you draw the line between what is necessary to discuss with a patient?
He says a doctor's judgment has to come first.
I don't think this should be about a particular issue like handgun usage or abortion or umbilical cord blood banking. The relationship between a doctor and a patient is sacred. There's really no business having somebody who isn't part of that demanding or requiring what goes on in that encounter.
This week, Pennsylvania Democrats held a public briefing on a bill called the Patient Trust Act. It's a bid to block laws that aren't medically accurate, that could interfere in the doctor-patient relationship. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Atlantic City's glitzy star seems to be fading. Three big casinos have closed, and that's having a big-time ripple effect. It has meant layoffs for about 8,000 casino workers, cooks, card dealers, servers, cleaners, all out of work. The massive industry layoffs mark one of the biggest tests of the Affordable Care Act in New Jersey since the new online insurance marketplaces took effect this year. And the newly unemployed are encountering a mix of promise and confusion. Alana Gordon reports.
Neil Cushell has been a card dealer at Showboat Casino for 3 decades. He's loved it. And with comprehensive health benefits costing his family less than $300 a month, he didn't have to think much about health care. But it was the first thing that came to mind when the casino shut down a couple weeks ago.
It was a stressful situation when we closed after 27 years, so I'm trying to do as much as I can to help my family at this time.
Cushell says he wouldn't be able to afford his necessary medications out of pocket. So, like many others, he's now turning to the ACA's health insurance marketplace for coverage. Cushell recently met with a broker inside the convention center in Atlantic City. The next ACA open enrollment period doesn't actually start until November. But for people like Cushell who experience a qualifying life event like losing a job, they can apply right away. Without any discounts, Cushell learns his selected family plan on the online marketplace would cost about $1,600 a month. He says that's about the same as what it would cost him to extend his previous work coverage through a federal program called COBRA. But it turns out he is eligible for some federal assistance. It brings the cost of his selected health plan down to about $600 a month. He'd hoped it would be cheaper.
I mean, my work was like $1,600, so it's $1,000 off. That's better than $16. I can manage that, I guess.
Several social service groups were recently on hand at the Atlantic City Convention Center to help the thousands of newly unemployed casino workers navigate what can be a complex maze of services and supports. Some workers with union contracts will have their coverage extended at no cost for a few more months. Others have had varying degrees of insurance, or none at all, making the ACA a primary next step. Tom Shea, a counselor with the New Jersey Hospital Association, says a person's options hinge on several factors, including age, family size, and annual income.
The biggest issue today has been that these people have 8 months of employment this year.
So for some workers earning close to or more than $44,000 this year, that might rub right up against the upper income threshold to qualify for federal discounts for insurance on the ACA marketplace. On the flip side, Shea has also seen a lot of low-income workers come in and qualify for New Jersey's expanded Medicaid. That includes Danny Payams and Jorge Berrio, who didn't have coverage through their casino jobs to begin with and didn't realize they were already eligible.
It's a surprise for us.
Right now, happy, yeah.
I can go to the doctor now and check myself and my friend. We're happy.
What kind of this is for health?
Yeah, so this is health insurance sign up right now. You're looking for health insurance?
Yes.
Akeem Malik walks up to Patrick Cronin, who's signing people in to meet with healthcare counselors. Malik explains she's the primary breadwinner for her family and just lost her cashier job of 7 years.
I know I have insurance, I have a lot of problems. Somebody told me Obamacare is here.
She isn't sure what her current insurance situation is or what her future options are. What she is sure of is that her son is sick and needs medical attention. Cronin advises her to contact her insurance first to clarify the extent of her coverage and then follow up with the counselors here.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, wait, we'll make sure you get taken care of.
Okay, thank you.
What do you think the likelihood is that there will be an option for Aki?
Really, really high. There'll be something that works out for her.
Thousands of casino workers sought help at the convention center during this 2-week event. But Cronin and others don't expect things to slow down with the coming of even more casino layoffs and the approaching ACA open enrollment period. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Coming up on The Pulse, the illness, the treatment, and then the stuff you don't want to hear.
Be positive. And other euphemisms for that. Think of how lucky you
God
are.
God never gives us more than we can handle.
People throw platitudes at you.
The aftermath of cancer, still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. The Mütter Museum in Philadelphia has attracted the curious and the squeamish for its vast display of pathological body parts, many suspended in jars. Peter Crimmins reports the 19th Century Medical Science Museum is also a magnet for artists looking for inspiration.
One of the plays in the current Philadelphia Fringe Festival is The Body-Lautrec. It's about the 19th century French painter Henri Toulouse-Lautrec and his bones. The show's creators, Mary Twominen and Aaron Cromie, developed a play with the help of the Mutter Museum, and they sat down to talk about how they made puppets based on the artist's deformed skeleton.
We would see him as one of these little child skeletons, like in the Mutter, which are so beautiful. Those little child skeletons are so adorable and gorgeous, and as a result, the puppets that Aaron has made, are just as gorgeous and adorable. And they suffer terrible fates during the course of the show.
Don't give away all the secrets.
I won't. All I'll say is syphilis.
Syphilis. She said syphilis. It's one of the secrets Twominen's partner, Aaron Cromie, would like to keep under wraps. Henri Toulouse-Lautrec was born with a congenital bone disease that warped his skeleton at an early age, and then later in life he contracted syphilis, which wreaked havoc on his already fragile bones. Now, I can't reveal too much about this play because I haven't seen it. I've only been to a rehearsal where the actors were working out a gory scene of 19th century surgery.
Christy is bringing my whole blood tray over, and then she'll peel it back to take the scalpel out and hand it to me.
The play shows how brutal surgery once was, because with no real means of killing pain, doctors with scalpels were basically torturing patients in their efforts to save them. Twominen says Henri Toulouse-Lautrec developed very close and very complicated relationships with his doctors.
There's a lovely interplay between this figure of the doctor, a very dark figure to Henri, who of course suffered so often in his childhood and has a really intense relationship with doctors as a result of how often he had his legs broken, how often his legs had to be reset, rebroken.
In 19th century medical science, people with extreme deformities were categorized as monsters. That was actually the clinical term for it, a monster. The archive of pathological artifacts at the Mutter Museum, those body parts floating in jars, were collected in an effort to turn monsters back into people. Dr. Thomas Mutter was a specialist in reconstruction surgery to correct gross deformities caused by birth defects, disease, or injury. He pioneered surgical techniques to do just that, but the author of a new biography called Dr. Mutter's Marvels says his lasting legacy might be empathy. Kristen Aptowitz says Mutter's insistence that patients be treated with sterile instruments and some form of anesthesia was initially resisted by the medical establishment.
The way that he taught generations of medical students to think of patients not as problems to be solved, but as human beings who you're trying to alleviate their suffering, that was a big calling for him, to alleviate human suffering.
Mutter also insisted that his collection of pathological artifacts be available for study by artists. When Mutter donated his collection to the College of Physicians of Philadelphia in 1858, artists were on his mind, says museum director Robert Hicks.
He intended this for scientific study, but even his legacy, the legal document that supports his legacy, states that hours must be appointed to have the museum open for artists. So even from the very beginning, art was in the picture.
At the time, artists needed the collection of preserved body parts to be able to illustrate anatomy books and sculpt wax models for instruction in medical schools. But now, the museum is open to art projects of every stripe. Hicks accepts proposals from musicians, filmmakers, performers, writers of fiction.
We pretty much say, have at it. If the research proposal makes sense, we'll welcome you here, and you can research anything you want as long as you don't break anything.
Recently, a pair of filmmakers called the Brothers Quay made a poetic documentary about the Mutter Museum, and a local writer wrote a series of short stories based on objects in the collection, like a book bound in human skin. Recently, the composer Jill Tracy flew out from San Francisco just to sit among the body parts late at night all alone and feel creepy feelings. This is what came out of it. Mary Twominen, that theater director making a show about Henri Toulouse-Lautrec, says the Mutter is open to anything.
Whenever you show up with an idea and you're like, well, we want to make a piece about a 19th century syphilitic painter and maybe you could help us out. And they're like, yes! We'll show you our gynecological tables. You're going to do prostitution. You need to know about abortion. You know, there's like a bunch of, it's really amazing. And we were like, well, we want to do a showing. Could we do it in the Mutter? And also people will be nude. And they were like, yes, absolutely. Come on over.
Tuominen's play, The Body Lautrec, opens this weekend as part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. An earlier version was previewed inside the Motor Museum, and yes, there was nudity. For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
Can't get enough of all that Mutter stuff. We had Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz on The Pulse last week. She was just quoted in Peter's story. She's written a new book about the doctor, his influence and legacy. It's really interesting. Check it out on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Between 10 and 15% of nurses in the United States have a substance abuse disorder. That's according to the American Nurses Association. For the general population, that number is around 8%. Being a nurse addicted to drugs or trying to get clean entails a lot of unique issues. Laura Benchoff reports.
It's a warm summer evening in New Jersey. About a dozen nurses gather under the hum of fluorescent lights in a church basement.
I don't know the story.
You don't know the story? Oh, my story's interesting.
Mike wears a button-down shirt. His brown hair and beard are cropped short. He and the other nurses huddle on squishy couches pulled into a big circle. Some, straight from work, wear scrubs. Some come in sweats and have glossy manicures. They're here for their weekly peer support meeting through New Jersey's Alternative to Discipline program called RAMP. It's where addicted nurses go when they want to detox and keep their jobs. Most don't want their names used, but Mike, the only man in the room, is happy to share his story.
I was in charge of an ER, you know, just directing the traffic in a very large ER, and I just one day said, on a slow day, stuck a needle in my leg, and then it was off to the races, and I'm smart, and I'm using a fresh needle every time. I'm smart, I know exactly what I'm doing, and then I'm in. By the time I got confronted in August of 07, I was grateful for the confrontation because I was the definition of the sick and tired of being sick and tired of being sick and tired. My wife at the time had a drug problem as well along with me. We both went to the same rehab. I was ready to change my life. She was not. She actually overdosed in rehab. So we parted ways and I came back up here.
Mike's story is not unusual. Carolyn Crowley, a nurse in Idaho, also battled prescription drug addiction.
I had some pain issues, some female pain. We had samples in our office. This was, you know, almost 20 years ago. So I was taking them prescribed by myself.
Crowley says nurses have a lot to deal with, and the combination of stress and access to drugs can be toxic.
You know, we do have a little bit of a different situation in that the stress of the job, the access is there, the triggers are there. Say they've worked, you know, three 12-hour shifts in a row. It's been incredibly hectic. Mrs. Jones had only wanted one of her pills instead of two. And now they're halfway home. There's a pill in their pocket. It's like, maybe this would help.
Crowley got caught stealing pills from her office. She's now been sober for 17 years and wrote a manual for nurses about getting clean and going back to work. She credits an Alternative to Discipline program for getting her back on her feet and letting her keep her career. The thinking is that if nurses stand to lose their jobs for going into rehab, they won't seek help. So a nurse in treatment is safer than one in hiding. And because the nurse is accountable, the public is safer too. 41 states now offer these programs. And they're strict. Nurses sign up for 3 to 5 years of drug testing and mandatory weekly meetings. Some nurses find that peer meetings, like this one in New Jersey, are more comfortable than regular 12-step meetings. Other addicts sometimes freak out because these nurses have people's lives in their hands.
That whole thing of how people think we should know better was killing me. Right. Was killing me. I didn't want to go to meetings. Oh, maybe I took care of them. Who cares?
I know. I could care less.
Oh, and I used to.
I see people at meetings. I'm like, yeah, that's right. I was your nurse.
Yeah. And I care less. And, no, but they're there too. But it's right. Different. You know what I mean?
Well, nurses have a higher standard. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. I just... It
doesn't happen to nurses.
You might be wondering, why give nurses a second chance to practice at all? Let's look at the big picture for a minute. There's been a nationwide shortage of nurses since the 1930s. New Jersey recently set aside $22 million to increase the number of training opportunities for new nurses. That means helping nurses get sober and keep their jobs makes sense for hospitals and for nurses. Suzanne Kinkle heads up New Jersey's Recovery and Monitoring Program, RAMP. She says accepting that nurses don't have to be perfect helps them get sober.
Last year, we had about 73% success rate remaining RAMP.
That means more than 70% of people who were in the program at the beginning of the year stuck out the terms of their contract until the end of the year. That's much higher than what conventional 12-step programs report. And Kinkle says if nurses want to go back to work, they have to prove to each other that they're ready.
Once they're compliant with the program, they do a presentation to their peer groups and request to go back to work. You know, they will call them out. If they think they're lying or not being 100% honest, they will call them out on their stuff, is a nice way of saying it.
That's just what Mike did, the nurse in recovery we heard from earlier. He was in the recovery and monitoring program for over 6 years, and he's come a long way.
So I've lost my house. I've lost my family as a result of my actions. But today, because the house didn't sell and I was able to get a job, I then moved back into my house that, you know, I own. You know, I have a great relationship with my children.
And you're remarried?
Oh, and I'm remarried, yes.
Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware each have an alternative to discipline program, and many addiction treatment centers now offer profession-specific programs for nurses. For The Pulse, I'm Laura Benshoff.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. It's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, recovery, and healing. Today, we hear from Susan Chase. She's a ballerina who learned she had breast cancer in her mid-40s. The diagnosis shattered her world, and some years later, she turned her experience with the illness into a one-woman performance called Susan's Undoing. It's part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival this year.
I was a very healthy, strong, active, I felt young woman, and went for my routine mammogram, never expecting that I would get a phone call saying, we have to speak with you. And when I did get that phone call, I didn't return it for several weeks. I was certain it was just a billing issue. When I did finally return the call, it was because there was an anomaly on my mammogram. Everyone around me said, oh, don't worry, I'm sure everything will be fine. But it wasn't. I did have to have several surgeries, actually, followed by radiation therapy. I felt an intense sense of betrayal. How could this happen to me?
I did everything
when
right.
When I've done everything I was supposed
I
to.
I took good care of my body. I was a ballet
dancer. I exercised every day of my life.
I watch my fat intake.
I'm super healthy. Life actually doesn't work that way. It doesn't always reward the good and punish the bad. When I was dealing with breast cancer, I discovered that the hardest part of that was not during treatment, as miserable as the treatments were. It was actually when treatment ended and you feel like the doctors stamp you with a C. You're cured, and then they push you out, and now it's the next person's turn, and you feel very lost. One thing I heard a lot during my treatment and afterwards was be positive and other euphemisms for that.
Think of how lucky you
God
are.
God never gives us more than we can handle.
People throw platitudes at you.
I personally found that to be extremely unhelpful. I just couldn't keep smiling and being positive. I had to express what I was really feeling. So I began journaling my feelings, journaling my experiences. And the journal entries eventually became my play.
Radiation. Talk about a scary word. It's invisible. You look around for some sign of its existence, what comes to mind? The microwave. Meat goes in moist and plump and comes out shriveled and cooked.
One of the most striking elements of Susan's undoing is a large industrial ladder that looms from one side of the stage to the other, and in most cases goes off into oblivion because it goes off beyond what the audience can see. I realized that I am a climber and a struggler, and the whole experience of cancer is an experience that seemed like it knocked me down to the bottom of that ladder again. And I was resurrecting myself in creating that play, climbing my way back onto that ladder.
Who is your support group?
Well, you know, that's the weird thing. I don't feel I have anyone. I really don't.
I needed to confront all the feelings that had been stirred up and do something with them. What I did with them was create Susan's undoing.
Whenever I would start to talk about it with someone, I would start feeling like I was performing again. Like
it's not a play about cancer. It's a play about getting through difficult times in one's life. This is a template for how to face the challenges of life, whether those challenges be physical, spiritual, emotional. It doesn't help anyone to bury their feelings, to deny their feelings. You need to confront them. The most therapeutic thing you can do is to tell your story. I want to encourage people in whatever way they need to tell their story.
Susan Chase is currently performing in this year's Philadelphia Fringe Festival, and we have all that information on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Jeanette Woods produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our associate producer, Megan Pinto is the executive producer. And now, this important announcement. You don't have to be driving to listen to The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes, you can listen on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. You can listen to The Pulse when you're folding laundry, when you're making dinner, when you're ironing shirts, whatever it is you're doing. There's also a really cool NPR app. It's called NPR One. It's kind of like Pandora for news and information, and Pulse stories are on there. So find us. You can listen to the whole show or just a couple of stories. Your pick. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your questions, your ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.